It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. Featuring stimulating, in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
To the show where we're balancing the intellectual with the creative, exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect everybody, locally and globally. And for this, the Arts Hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And I combine a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. If you want to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts of all my past shows there. If you enjoy this interview today, you can tell your friends about it, send them to the website, they can listen to the podcast. And you can also connect with me on social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. So again, the show website is itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing Tess Morris, screenwriter of the wonderful 2015 romantic comedy film Man Up, starring Simon Pegg and Lake Bell. Born and raised in Wandsworth, London, Tess went to university studying a TV and film degree. In 1997, while still attending university, Tess wrote the short film Beer Goggles, which was directed by award-winning Scottish director David Mackenzie. Beer Goggles won the Lloyds Bank Channel 4 Film Challenge and was shown on the Channel 4 network in Britain. After university, Tess became a journalist for teen news publishers, where she regularly interviewed the cast of Hollyoaks, which is a popular British soap opera. Tess went on to become a writer for Hollyoaks, writing 18 episodes over 2 years, and became known for her comedic scripts. She also wrote for the primetime UK sitcom My Family and worked as script editor for the British Film Institute and Film 4, while continuing to work on her own original scripts. In 2008, Tess was chosen for the BFI Skillset Think, Shoot, Distribute scheme for emerging talent in the British film industry. Her first feature film screenplay, the romantic comedy Man Up, made the 2011 Brit list, was picked up by Big Talk Pictures, co-produced by Studio Canal and BBC Films, and released in 2015, directed by Ben Palmer and starring the fabulous Simon Pegg and Lake Bell. Tess has worked extensively as a script editor with Seinfeld writer Tom Leopold and also lectures on comedy and screenwriting for the Arvon Foundation and Royal Holloway University, London. In 2015, Tess was honoured as one of BAFTA's Select Breakthrough Brits, an initiative which supports upcoming British creative talent. Tess is currently writing an original screenplay called Secret Santa for Big Talk Studio Canal and Textbook Behaviour for Big Talk BBC Films. She's also doing a rewrite on a feature for Sony and is currently living in Los Angeles. Welcome to the show, Tess.
That was an amazing intro. Thank you.
So, just to start off, I like to ask people if, can you remember the first time that art of any kind, whether it was a book or a picture or music, had a deep effect on you, when you realised that art has a power beyond just entertainment?
Oh, yes. I think probably like my first sort of love of something artistic was probably when my dad used to read me Wind in the Willows. Actually, which recently I went on the Disneyland ride for.
Oh, do they have one? I didn't know that.
Well, they have like a Toad Hall ride.
Oh, yes.
But I think I went on when I was about 8, but then I just went on recently aged 39, which is a whole different experience. but yeah, I remember my dad, he used to read a lot and do all the voices as parents do, but he was particularly good at it because I think in another life my dad probably wished he was an actor. So he used to do, you know, Moley, Ratty, Toadie, all the voices. And I remember just really enjoying the whole world of that book. And we had a big kind of tome of it, like an edition of it that had lots of sort of illustrations in it as well and everything. Mm. So yeah, that was probably like in terms of like literature, and then in terms of sort of more the power of sort of emotional creative stuff, I guess probably Elvis Presley. And we have a family myth that my first words were actually Elvis, because my parents used to say who's the king, and I used to say Elvis. I don't know if that's strictly true, but it's a good myth anyway.
Yes, yeah.
So I remember being very young and watching his concerts.
Right.
And the other thing I remember watching very acutely is The Sound of Music. And I remember being so excited by it that my mum, I didn't want to leave the room and I needed to use the potty. So my mum put the potty like outside of the room so I could still watch through the crack in the door. Because I was like, I can't leave. I have to know what happens to the nuns.
Yes.
So I was always I sort of grew up in a house that had lots of art and literature and books and music and film, you know, kind of constantly.
Yeah.
So I think I've probably been aware of it from quite an early age.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you grew up in a creative environment, which patently you did.
Yeah, well, interestingly, they're not. My dad does write now. He writes sort of children's plays and things, but actually, historically, my parents' careers were not. They were more, my dad was an antique dealer, and my mum was actually a radiographer and then became, sort of helped my dad out in the shop and various things like that. So they're more creative in their cultural life than their professional, so to speak, which I always think is great anyway. Like, you know, you don't necessarily, you don't have to do it for a job, obviously.
No, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So when did you decide that you did want to do it as a job then? And when did you decide specifically screenwriting?
I don't know if I've ever actually made that decision.
Well, you did a film degree, so you were kind of directionally moving there.
Yeah. Well, but that kind of came about very accidentally in some ways. This is my Martin Scorsese story. I was quite sickly as a child. I used to get a lot of tonsillitis, and I still actually can hear my throat today. Sorry, it's a bit croaky, but my throat is my thing, as they say in health terms. So I used to watch a lot. I used to have a lot of time off school, and subsequently my mum would go down to what we called Blockbuster Video, and we would get, you know, she'd get me out two videos for £1.50 or whatever. And so I used to watch, like, be on the sofa a lot watching stuff. So I always feel quite grateful that I ended up doing a job that it didn't feel like a total waste of time, me watching all of those things. But I think what kind of happened was, at school, I'm terrible at maths and science, and I think they're actually just as creative subjects as English. And I would never dismiss them as, you know, I think some people say, oh, I hate maths and I'm rubbish at it. I mean, I genuinely am terrible at maths. I mean, it's a thing for me. My throat and maths are the two things that I'm weak on. So I would always be given, you know, lots of, I obviously like would be kind of like, sort of, I don't know, sort of geared towards, you know, doing competitions for writing rather than anything else. So I used to like write lots of poetry, and I used to do all that kind of sort of stuff. And when I sort of reached sort of my teens, obviously then rebelled and decided to do no work at all. And then when I had applied for lots of university places, I don't know how it works in the States, but in the UK, you know, you sort of apply for sort of up to five, I think, I was doing it. And I had quite delusions of grandeur. I applied for like really sort of, you know, quite good universities to do like very serious English degrees. And then I didn't really get the grades, and then went off traveling around the world and declared that I wasn't going to university and I didn't need it. And, you know, my mum and dad were like, okay, yeah, bye, obviously. And then I got back and realised that literally my entire friendship group was leaving for university, and I wasn't. So I went, I remember my dad and mum opening up the kind of paper, and we have a thing called clearing. I don't know if you have that here, where you see what the place is available, what's left.
Right, yes.
And I remember sort of scanning down with my finger and seeing this degree called film. It was called Film, TV, Literature and Theatre Studies, and it was at Ripon and York St John, which is in York in the north of England. And I phoned them up and said, would you accept me? And they looked at my grades and said yes. And I kind of was like, okay. So off I went to York, which is about sort of 4 hours drive from London, which was very, very good for me because I'm a born and bred Londoner, and it was very good to experience another sort of part of England and not just sort of stay in the comfort of my own sort of, you know, home. So, yeah, so it was kind of an accidental university thing. And then job-wise, when I came out of university, I didn't really know what to do because I'd won that short film competition, but it's, you know, obviously you don't just walk into a job as a scriptwriter. It doesn't kind of really work like that.
No.
So I actually started off as a journalist instead, and like you said in the intro, sort of, you know, because of that, by osmosis, used to interview lots of people who were in shows, because I was more kind of like a celebrity journalist, like a teen magazine journalist, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
And then once I got Hollyoaks off the back of that, that was my first experience, obviously, like paid scriptwriting work, and I sort of believed at that point that, oh, brilliant, this is my life now. I'm just going to earn money living as, you know, as a writer. And and it didn't really work on board like that. Because obviously soap opera is one of the few regular gigs in the writing world, and you can earn a very good living from it, but you don't really want to do it for the rest, the whole of your career, because,
no.
You know, it's not, it's a great, great apprenticeship. Like, I would 100% recommend it. But after a couple of years when I stopped it, and then the money kind of stopped coming in, and I suddenly was like, oh, right, I now need to work out a way to do this job properly. And I would say it took me like another 5 to 7 years from then to actually be able to say I am earning enough to pay my rent and, you know, live a life as a writer. So, and I still sometimes every now and then I'm like, oh, what am I doing? Am I doing this job? You know, because it's one of those jobs that has such highs and lows. And
yeah.
You can go from feeling absolutely brilliant about what you've written to the worst writer in the world. So
yeah.
It's complex on that level.
Yes, absolutely. And sort of sadly, in the arts, I think in all areas, it just is very challenging to make a living, isn't it? You know, I mean,
have support, yeah. I mean, I could not have done it without being able to live at home and, you know, be able to, you know, like I was back and forth to my mum and dad numerous times in the past 15 years. And, you know, it's up to recently, I was still at home at some points. So, yeah, you've got to have that kind of support. Or you've just got to be able to be very disciplined and do a day job, but do it as your night job until it kind of, you know, morphs into your day job as well.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest from the arts this week, screenwriter of the wonderful romantic comedy film Man Up, Tess Morris. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back with more conversation after these messages. Mark's Art Party is the largest and wildest arts festival in the Bay Area, running September 24th through October 1st at Santa Clara County Fairgrounds. With 34,000 square feet of gallery space, music, dance, art cars, food trucks, fire, fashion and film, described as Burning Man in a tux, it's like nothing you've ever experienced before, and it benefits Silicon Valley Creates. The largest, most diverse art event the Bay Area has ever seen. This year's theme is Alice in Wonderland through the Looking Glass. You're more than just a viewer, you become a participant. Come along to Ann and Mark's Art Party September 24th through October 1st at Santa Clara County Fairgrounds. For more information, visit artpartysj.com. Artpartysj.com. That's artpartysj.com. Express yourself.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
I'm Casey, and I'm the second-generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, screenwriter Tess Morris. And we heard from Bookshop Santa Cruz in the break there, and I wanted to let you know that we've got some great author talks coming up at Bookshop Santa Cruz in September. On September the 22nd at 7 p.m, Craig Johnson, author of the popular Longmire Mysteries, returns to Bookshop Santa Cruz with a new installment in the Walt Longmire series called An Obvious Fact. If you have any middle graders in the house, then on September 27th at 4 p.m, New York Times best-selling author Lisa McMahon, is talking about her new book, Going Wild, described as Spider-Man meets Animorphs. And finally, on September 28th at 7, best-selling author Amy Stewart talks about her book, Lady Cop Makes Trouble, a feisty adventure set at the beginning of the 20th century. And information on all these great events can be found at their website, bookshopsantacruz.com. Well, back to my conversation with Tess. And I mentioned in the introduction, Tess, that your first feature film screenplay called Man Up was made into a wonderful film starring Simon Pegg and Lake Bell. And you'd been writing scripts for TV shows and done a short film. But I'm just wondering what was happening in your life at the point that you decided to go for it and write a full length feature for the first time.
Yeah. Very good question, because there was a lot happening. Yeah, I had actually given up writing for a couple of years. This is back in, I think, 2010, I think. I'd been through the ringer a little bit in terms of sort of relationships, and had one end and then had another one kind of fail. It's a theme in my life that I'm looking at and working on. I was the last relationship that had ended. I'd sort of like had been quite sort of calm about it in terms of, okay, well, that wasn't meant to be, but it'd given me some hope, which I hadn't had for a while. And about 6 months before it ended, I'd been standing under the clock at Waterloo, and this guy had come over and thought I was his blind date. And I'd said, no, I'm not Claire, and he'd walked off. And I thought, that's quite a good idea for a sort of setup for a movie. Someone that says yes rather than no. I'm a big fan of the what if in creative life. Like, what if I didn't do that? What if I did that instead? And obviously, I didn't say yes and go on the date. But it also made me, at the time, I was a script reader for the BFI and for Film 4 at home, and I was reading lots of scripts that were kind of, I mean, in all honesty, not that great. So it was starting to make me think, well, maybe I should go back and start writing again, because, you know, like, I can do as good as this at the very least. So I was living at home again with my mum and dad, because I'd been with them for a while, and I said to them, I've got this idea for a film, I'm going to write it, and if it doesn't work, I promise you I will go out and get a proper job finally.
Whatever that is.
Exactly. I mean, absolutely no idea what I meant by that. But I sort of said to myself, yeah, I will do this last chance saloon kind of script. And I think I was 33 at the time. So I sort of like sat down and just wrote it on spec, as they call it, speculatively, and sort of was quite disciplined with myself, something I need to remember and tap back into all these years later every now and then. I'm like, Tess, you did that. You were really disciplined. Come on, you can do it again. So it took 3 months to do it. And then had a sort of script editor, a friend of mine who I kind of like enlisted to kind of keep me on track, and he would read various drafts of it, and like he'd read act one and then we'd meet up and do notes. And I've always been a huge fan of the romantic comedy genre, and we could talk for 4 hours about it if you wanted, but I really wanted to write something that I think, you know, they're so dismissed all the time as a genre, and I find it endlessly fascinating why people would do that, because there are good and bad ones, just like all genres of movie. But I felt like there hadn't been just a sort of a modern one with a kind of twist in terms of that didn't rely on mobile phones and still had a kind of old-fashioned screwball kind of manner to it. And obviously, because it had actually happened to me under the clock, I felt like this is something that actually, you know, this is not a crazy idea. This is something that I can work with and run with.
Yeah. For listeners who haven't seen the film, can you give a brief synopsis without giving too much away, you know?
Yeah, so our heroine, Nancy, is very disillusioned. Oh, she's me, basically. Very disillusioned about dating life and doesn't really want to put herself out there and take chances and, you know, kind of like be open to love, and people are constantly telling her that she needs to do that. So when she's under the clock and this guy comes over, she kind of takes the mantle and decides to say, okay, so everyone's telling me that I need to, you know, do this. They're like, well, we didn't say that you had to pretend to be someone else's blind date, but okay. So she goes on the date with this 40-year-old kind of divorcee played by Simon Pegg, and they proceed to have a sort of one crazy night out together, where she does actually come clean reasonably soon that she's not his date, and that's sort of where the fun begins, because rather than being understanding about that, he's absolutely furious because he was supposed to meet a 20-something girl under the clock and she's 30-something. And it's very much about everyone in the film manning up, and, you know, Simon's character Jack having to also look at his own hang-ups about what he is looking for in life. And it's all set in London town, and as I say, London town, like an old-fashioned Londoner there, but it's all set in London, and it all takes place over kind of 36 hours or so. So it's fast-paced, frenetic, and ultimately 100% romantic comedy in terms of genre beats and payoffs. So it's no spoiler to say that they do get together at the end, but how they get together is obviously... Yeah, the important thing.
Absolutely. According to Billy Murnett, author of writing the romantic comedy, all the Hollywood studios and most major actors are actively seeking romantic comedies, but the same studios and actors reject hundreds of romantic comedies a month. So it would seem that romantic comedy is very popular, but it's also very hard to write. Did you realise that it was very hard to write when you started?
I don't know. I mean, Billy is a good friend of mine, and his book was How I Wrote Man Up. I didn't know him before. I actually basically stalked him after I wrote Man Up. I emailed him to say that I'd written this film that had been auctioned and that his book had basically helped me write it. And then we became email friends, and then I came to LA and met him, and now we're very good friends, and he regularly consults for me on scripts that I write. And he is 100% encyclopedic about romantic comedy and is a story consultant at Universal. I think me and Billy talk about this a lot. I think that what people forget about romantic comedy is that you have to have, just like all movies, you have to have emotional truth to it. And it has to really be about something. It cannot just be about boy meets girl, girl meets boy. And I think a lot of scripts that probably get written are sort of possibly fail to tap into that. If you think about your favourite romantic comedies, like When Harry Met Sally and Annie Hall, they have such huge themes about life and love and happiness, and they're not a simple story about two people getting together. And I think also sometimes people try and put too much of a high concept on it and then forget about the kind of character. I mean, for me, all good movies, you remember the people in them rather than the plot, ultimately. I mean, that is what a great film should do. So I think that maybe people, writers in particular of romantic comedies, you know, they don't... If you want to write one, I would say read Billy's book, and because it's brilliant, and he's incredibly perceptive about what makes something work. But, you know, it's difficult. I mean, I think people are always going to want to watch films about falling in love and falling out of love. I mean, I can't imagine a world where we wouldn't. I guess what's changing a lot is that people are less likely to go to the cinema to watch them now. Which is a real shame, because it's, you know, for me, the ultimate date night movie, you know. And also, I'm going to be 40 next year. I grew up, you know, cinema's a huge part of my life. But that said, I do love to Netflix and chill, so
yes.
I can't really blame people. And Man Up did incredibly well on home entertainment. It was one of those movies, I think, that people like to just put on, and it's comforting, and they know what they're going to get from it, hopefully.
Yeah.
So.
I know I've watched it 10 times, I think.
Oh, thank you.
Honestly,
I do think it bears a few watches. It's one of those movies, because it goes by so quickly at first. So.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I think the best romantic comedies are about redemption in a way, that way we feel there can be hope where we felt there was none before. And that's not just hope about love, but about being human. Is that something you see?
Oh, my God, yes. I mean, like, I think about sort of, because my personal life is like, you know, in terms of like, you know, apropos of this show being about balance, you know, I think because my personal life has been so kind of different, my personal life has been the least likely romantic comedy in the world, you know, and I think that's sort of part of my journey, actually. Like, it's why I like to write romantic comedies, because I like to explore why people break up or get back together, and what makes two people connect on a chemistry level, and, you know, what is actually love, and, you know, and as I get older, I'm sort of, my mind changes the whole time about all those kind of things. So I think that I'm constantly trying to redeem myself as a person in terms of how I treat relationships and how I kind of conduct them. And I guess in movie terms, it's incredibly important that there's a universal theme for your viewer to tap into, that they might not be able to understand saying yes to someone under the clock who thinks that you're their blind date, but they will be able to understand how it's not being able to put yourself out there and wanting to meet people, and how that can be, in the modern world, hugely overwhelming, you know? I'm not of the Tinder generation, and...
Oh, God.
Yeah. I know, and it's great, though. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, I have lots of friends on it, and I sit and I look at their phones, and I'm like, wow, like... God, there's all these men on your phone, and these women. But I personally just can't sort of seem to find a way into that side of it. So I'm always thinking about how to meet people without having to do that. And, you know, even leaving the house as a writer can be a massive deal, let alone leaving the house to meet someone. So
yes, yeah, absolutely. I have a master's degree in counselling, and one of the things that interests me in art is archetypes, whether they use consciously or unconsciously, and thinking about romantic comedies, you know, you have these strong male and female characters trying to come together, and archetypally we have our sort of inner masculine and feminine, which we need to develop and merge in order to be whole. I'm wondering if you ever think about romantic films in that way, in terms of archetypes. And I know sometimes when I am watching them, I sort of feel like something's happening on a deeper level that's, I mean, all the things you've been talking about, I think, are there as well. But also just there's a sort of, I don't know, with a really good one, you can just feel more whole afterwards. Do you ever think about archetypes?
No, totally. I mean, like, Nora Ephron was, like, who I named my cat after. you know, she was the ultimate at making you sort of feel like that. I don't know, I think it's quite complex in terms of archetypes now for women, particularly. Mm. I had to defend... I mean, I got, there were various sort of points that people like got annoyed about the title of Man Up. Like, we got accused of being, you know, anti-feminist.
And
I was just exhausted by that. I was like, okay, yes. So number one, watch the film first and understand what I'm saying as Man Up. Secondly, you know, understand that we are trying to reclaim the word a bit, you know, and not make it such a gung-ho masculine kind of phrase. And
yes.
So that in itself was complex for me. Also, I'm a woman, you know.
Yes, yeah.
So it's like, I have not written an anti-feminist film. And also, I think that I'm a big sort of fan of women being people rather than women in movies. And
yes.
I really, really tried hard with Nancy to just make her a rounded person rather than trying to say anything in particular about being a female. But at the same time, you know, you think about a character like Bridget Jones, who's just become the kind of... And I love Bridget, you know, I love the first movie, but yes. I am not like Bridget Jones, but I can tap into her archetype and understand that I know women like that.
Yes.
But I think it's also incredibly complex nowadays because we're told as women, you know, you shouldn't, you know, you don't need a man, you don't need, or a woman or whatever, you know. And personally for me, I am starting to come to terms with that maybe I'm not going to have a conventional relationship and family and like other people, but I'm actually starting to understand that that could be very good for me and could open my eyes to sort of a different way of living. But that said, there are still lots of people who get married and have babies and still need to be represented on screen, you know?
Yes, absolutely, like, yeah. Well, I think it's all part of this kind of distortion that's come about through feminism, unfortunately, which I deal with more in the other part of my show where I you know, have topics or discussions. But I think what we want to see, or at least I want to see, is female and male attributes valued equally. And what we've got a lot through feminism is that, you know, women have to be like men to be equal, you know, because masculine traits have always been valued more than what are thought of as feminine traits. And obviously men and women can have both masculine and feminine traits, and
Hopefully.
So sort of caring and nurturing and all of that, it's sort of like, oh, we don't do that anymore, you have to go and become a CEO of a company. And it's like, if you want to do that, great, but if you don't, then the nurturing and caring is the same value. And I think we're still struggling with that, you know. Even women are not valuing those things. They're trying to replace them with things that men have decided have value.
I know, and it's interesting, isn't it? The sort of like, there's also these, you know, tendency for men to be like, I'm a feminist, and then I start, and then they start to mansplain feminism to you.
Yes. You're like, oh dear.
To say that they're a feminist because they've got daughters, or, you know, they're a son, and it's like, okay, this is not what it's about. I mean, for me, it's all about leveling the playing field, to be honest.
Yes, access.
I don't think it's about us. You know, men are always going to feel a certain way about women and vice versa. I mean, I don't think that's going to change. I think in cultural representations of us, though, I just think, I always remember the writers of Flight of the Conchords saying something great, because I love that show, and I thought that the two male characters were just brilliantly written. And the writers were asked about how they wrote them, and they said, well, we kind of just write them as women. And I was like, that is genius, because actually you're just giving them all, like you just said, you're giving them some of those tropes of being a female, but they are men. And I kind of like think, I don't, whenever I get called a female writer, I'm like, what is, I'm a writer, and there are men in my movies, and there are older men, and there are younger men, and there are, you know, it's, that's what I think is the most important thing, of just saying, let's not just put you in a box and say, you're all the female writers. I get a bit nervous about even events that are just about female film people, because I'm like, surely I need to be on a panel with just a load of other writers, not just with a load of other female writers, because that only levels the playing field for me.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I think sadly it's sort of like race, particularly in America, you know, where the sort of positive discrimination also almost became necessary, because otherwise no one would ever be represented. I mean, I know there's certain people now, I'm trying to think, I think it is in film, where women have said they just won't be on a panel if they're the only woman, you know, because, men are saying they won't be on a panel if there aren't any women, because they, you know, it's just sort of ridiculous. But
I think, you know, at the end of the day, it's obviously it's a very complicated thing to find any one solution to.
Absolutely.
But I think at the very least, just being open to, and not, you know, let's not ganging up on each other or putting people in boxes is, you know, the most important thing. So.
Absolutely, yes. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, screenwriter Tess Morris. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Do you like like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com. It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at AnandaScottsValley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's AnandaScottsValley.org or 338-YOGA.
It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my special guest from the arts this week, screenwriter of the wonderful 2015 romantic comedy film Man Up, Tess Morris. So before the break, we were talking a little bit about the feminist reaction to the title Man Up, and I'm kind of surprised in a way because I think the film's wonderful in every way, but I certainly wouldn't have seen anything in it to upset feminists. But I was also thinking so many Hollywood films have a huge age gap with the lead male actor inevitably quite a bit older than the female lead. And so it was refreshing to see a romantic film. I mean, I know they're not the same age, Lake Bell and Simon Pegg, but they're at least in the same ballpark. And, you know, they look like they're similar, you know. Yeah. Is that something you consciously wanted to do?
Yeah, I mean, in the film she's 34 and he's nearly 40, or he is 40. I always think most people seem to be like a like 5-year gap, I think, because women obviously are far mature,
maturer
than men,
yes.
So 5 years kind of levels us out, so to speak. It's funny with the age thing because I can only really, I mean, I'm one of those people that, I really like to write who I know, and obviously rather than what I know, and obviously who I know is lots of women in their mid to late 30s and 40s now. So that's sort of my go-to world when I write about sort of romance and things.
Yes.
And actually, the thing that I'm currently writing, well, in fact, all the things I'm writing at the moment are they're in their late 30s, early 40s. I also think there's so many actresses at the moment who can nail that that age group. So, I mean, that's not to say I'm writing one thing that is a 30-year-old perspective, and I'm trying to tap back into my, you know, nearly 10 years ago, and it's quite fun because it's quite good to remember the things that you would have told yourself at 30,
yes.
What you know now kind of sort of thing. But, I rewatched it the weekend. I was watching Something's Got to Give at the weekend. You know, the Diane Keaton and the Nancy Meyers one. And I was really struck by how great it is, because in that she starts to date Keanu Reeves, Diane Keaton, in that movie.
Right.
And there's a line where they're having dinner and she's like, I'm nearly 20 years older than you. And he's like, I don't have a problem with that.
Right, yes, yeah.
And me and my friend who were watching it, who were both in our late 30s, were like, hooray, maybe we should date younger men. But, you know, it's eternally, you know, you can't change, like I was saying earlier, human nature, you know. I mean, I think that, you know, the tradition of the older man liking, you know, slightly younger, easier women, I suppose, I don't blame them for that. I can't say if I was a man that I would act much more differently, but I certainly like to get angry about it in my writing, because that's what I do feel quite passionately about. I'm like, but I'm right here and I'm the same age as you, dude, so why are you going 10 years younger? But, you know.
Yes, yeah.
Can't change the world.
Well, I had a Hollywood producer on the show, Jonathan Dana, and I was asking him about this. I was saying, do you think we'll ever see a time, you know, where the leads will be the same age? And he was sort of saying, it's just aspirational. You know, the men making the film, they're just sort of thinking, you know, if they could, like you said, what if? But I think we are seeing a change, and particularly in television more than film, perhaps.
More,
you know,
way more.
Yes, yeah. So,
I mean, you look at, like, you know, Catastrophe, and like Sharon Horgan is in her mid-40s in that, and she's amazing and brilliant, and good in Man Up. You know, like, I think that TV is, you know, I mean, it's tricky, because people often sort of say to me, oh, you know, romantic comedy's dead in film and it's alive in television, and I'm like, well, the film is, I mean, one of my favourite sort of sayings is that film is a one-night stand and television is a long-term relationship. Mm. So, you know, as much as, yes, there are lots of romantic comedy stories being played out on television, what TV has is, you know, endless time to tell a story, and to keep us on tenterhooks and not knowing what's going to happen, and to play out, you know, these huge arcs that can go for 10, 12 episodes.
Yes.
Whereas the art of writing a romantic comedy film that has to, you know, end at the end of it is equally as difficult and challenging. And I think there's still a total space for it, because I think that sometimes people just want that one hit.
Yeah.
On the, you know, so to speak.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I understand you had quite a bit of interaction with Simon Pegg with regard to the script, and with both the leads on set. Now, I was thinking about that. Is that common on films that the writer gets to do that? Because I have this impression of Hollywood films that they don't even want the writer around, sort of interfering. You know.
Well,
so.
There were two reasons, really. The first is that Big Talk, who made the film, are incredibly writer collaborative and friendly. I mean, they make Edgar Wright films, and you know, they are all about the writer. Actually, three things. So that's the first thing, is that the Big Talk writer vibe. And the second thing was Ben Palmer, my director, who is just brilliant, and said to me, I remember saying to him, do you want me on set sometimes? And he was like, I want you on set every day, Tess. I was like, okay. So that was kind of the second thing. He's not a frustrated writer himself. He's just a director. So that was an amazing experience for me.
Yeah.
And thirdly, Simon, who again is a brilliant writer himself, who wanted to help me just throw stuff at me. And I'm not going to say no to Simon Pegg. He's amazing, and he's one of my script writing heroes.
So, yes. Yeah.
I remember him saying to me, do you want me to have a look at the draft and throw some jokes? And I was like, yes. he's also a master improviser. But what's brilliant about Simon is that I always remember I loved him so much, and he's become a dear friend now. Whenever he was interviewed about Man Up, and people would say, oh, what, so did you improvise the whole thing? And he'd go, not in the slightest. What I did was use Tess's brilliant script. Thank you, Simon. Use Tess's brilliant script to then throw in some stuff, and I can't improvise unless the script is there. And that's what a really good actor acknowledges, and also someone who writes himself, you know, who doesn't try and say. I think now this tendency to say, yeah, we improvise the whole thing. It's like, okay, well, maybe some of you did, because that was the constraints of what your director said, throw out the script and just improvise.
Yes.
But we were not like that on Man Up at all. And there are beats in the film that Simon are all Simon, and I love him for every single one of them, because they came out of a very organic process. And I'll happily tell everybody his little improvs and stuff I didn't write, because they, you know, they only made the film better, so.
Yes, yeah. As you said, he is a brilliant actor and writer, but he has said he finds it hard to write women. How about you writing men? Do you find that more of a challenge?
No, I don't. I mean, like, and actually, I think Simon said he found it, he literally said that in one interview about writing.
Oh, and it's sort of followed him everywhere.
Yeah, it has. And it was actually in an interview with me. And he was just saying that when him and Edgar used to write, they just found it a challenge to, they were younger then, you know?
Yes, yeah.
And I would say as well that I definitely feel more comfortable writing women, but I have a lot of fun writing men. But I do tend to write the same types of men, but then I do tend to write the same types of women. I mean, if that's your voice, then
yes, yeah,
that's your voice.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say I find it difficult. I just find it maybe slightly more interesting in terms of, like,
yes,
sort of challenging myself to not just write the same kind of man. And also, sometimes you just write yourself a fantasy boyfriend, to be honest.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Like Mark Darcy or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Like, who would I like to go out with? Okay, that's what I'm going to write. And that actually can be really bad, because then you don't write a flawed person.
Yes.
And you write someone that is, like, not realistic.
Well, then it does become more archetypal, I think, like fairy tales, you know, which have had a bad rap, but I think if you think of them archetypally, they're very interesting, you know, and that's why they resonate with us so much. But
I remember when I first watched Frozen, not that it's a romantic comedy, but I remember turning to the person I was watching it with, just at the moment where you realise what the film is about, and I remember going, oh, it's not about her. It's not about the love for a man. It's about the love for her sister. Like, I was, like, so overwhelmed.
Yes.
Because I'd spent the whole film thinking, you know, this is a fairy tale romantic thing about her getting the prince, and then you realise that she does get the prince, but it's more about, you know, reuniting and bonding with her sister. So I thought it was, I mean, you know, it's a kind of slightly quirky example in terms of bringing up Frozen, but I thought it was such a great female film for girls to watch.
Yes,
for young women to watch and be like, oh, right, I can have the man, but I can also have something else as well.
So. Yes, yeah, absolutely. I did want to ask you, I'm really interested in the writings of the psychologist Alice Miller, and she's written at length about how art can help people process difficult events, whether they're events they've experienced themselves or events perhaps that they've witnessed. I'm wondering if you feel art can have a healing effect on those making art and those experiencing it.
I think, like, 100%. I think that it's funny because so many of my exes and men in my life think that my writing's about them, and I always have to say it's actually about me. It's not really about you. Never date a writer. I mean, if you've got any kind of ego, I will take you down. But I think that with art, if you can tap into something universal in people, then it can be like the most healing thing ever. And it's why I like romantic comedies, because I think that, and I don't think fundamentally that anyone should be alone. I mean, I'm not talking about necessarily marriage or conventional relationship, but I think people need people and or animals or whatever, you know, like,
yes,
I've just recently got a cat, and I've left my two cats back in London with my parents, so I just adopted a cat because I've been volunteering at a cat rescue place. And it's really changed my life again. I'd forgotten what it was like to kind of, like, have that healing effect of having someone around you. And I think that cinema and art and everything, that's its job, you know, to make you not feel alone, really.
Yes, that's a good point,
When you watch something or you read something or you listen to something, I've just been listening non-stop to the new Nick Cave album, and, you know, it's kind of equally heartbreaking but also incredibly uplifting. But I feel connected to it, you know, and I feel if I am going to have a cry listening to it, it's a good thing, you know. It's, you know, I am the type of person that you will pull up next to at the lights and I will be singing, like, If Take My Breath Away by Berlin Has Come On. Like, that's what I will be singing loudly in the car, you know? It's like, I think that I find anything artistic that makes me feel anything, a level of healing occurs, because I don't feel, you know, I don't feel that kind of solitude feeling suddenly.
Yes.
Like if I'm at home sometimes and I haven't got music on or I haven't got, I suddenly remind myself, oh, put like now I've got like some amazing Sonos contraption in my place. Like I can put on like, you know, a Duke Ellington radio or something and it'll just play like that all day.
Yeah.
It's really good because then you go, oh, I'm now listening to something and I don't feel like I'm just sat in a echoey room on my own.
Yes. Yeah.
But you know, equally it's healing for the person who's creating the art. You know, with Man Up, I definitely, you know, I've said before, I kind of threw it up to a certain extent.
Yes,
you know,
yeah,
based on lots of things that I was going through.
Yeah.
And the new thing I'm writing is very much based, the new film for Big Dog is very much based on being dumped at age 37 and having a massive panic about it.
Right, so, yes, yeah.
You know, I definitely, most of the time when things are happening to me, in the back of my head I'm thinking, you're going to write about this at some point, though.
Yes.
However painful and awful it is, and because I write comedy, I realise that I am going to be able to get some light from the shade, which is always good as well. So.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great thing with comedy. You can say things and address things and people will receive them, which perhaps they wouldn't if it was done in a more serious way, you know. So
yeah. Yeah.
You get in the back
it
door
takes a
sometimes.
While
yeah.
To get there. I mean, I've tried to write when I've been in. The one I'm writing at the moment, which I tried to write it when I was in the kind of first throes of a really big kind of life crisis as well.
Yeah.
And I wrote the angriest romantic comedy ever written. and I couldn't tap into, and I really struggled for, you know, a good 6 months of, I couldn't find the lightness in it because I wasn't actually in the lightness yet myself.
Yes, yeah.
And I never lose my sense of humour. That is something that I've had sort of drilled into me from my family. You know, we tend to never lose that, which is, you know, a good thing. But I definitely wasn't ready to write it yet. And sometimes you have to... I think a lot of writers forget to live it before they write it.
Yes,
Or even just to live it generally, you know. I know people that just, they're like, I've got, you know, they're struggling with their writing, and I'm like, well, leave the house and talk to someone.
Yes,
because you can't just sit and stare at your computer for days and days and days, because that way does not lie, well, madness lies that way.
Yes, absolutely. Well, sadly, we've come to the end of the show, but it's been lovely talking to you. And
thank you.
I want to really encourage listeners to see Man Up. I know it's on Netflix, because that's
Netflix,
where I've seen
Amazon,
it.
Amazon, iTunes, everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it really is brilliant. I just was with some friends on Saturday night, and they thought they had seen every Simon Pegg film. I was like, oh my God, you've got to see this. I've sent them like a picture of the poster and everything.
Oh, thank you. And also, you know, it's 88 minutes long, so it's like, fast, you know,
consumable. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for writing it, and
thank you.
Thanks for coming on the show. It's been brilliant having you.
Brilliant. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, I just want to remind everyone again about the website. It's aquestionofbalance.com. And as I said, if you enjoyed this interview right now, you can tell your friends about it. Go to the website. You'll find information about Tess, a link to where you can find out more about her, photos, and of course the audio. So I really, really encourage you to check out Man Up, and look out for Tess's future work, because Man Up is brilliant. So I'm assuming that her other films are going to be too. Anyway, it's been great having you with me and with Tess, and I will see you next time.